Good afternoon, Your Honors. Matthew Crowther, number 39146, on behalf of the defendant appellant, Ronald Gilbert. As the court's aware, the first issue that's raised by the appellant on appeal is one with regard to speedy trial and the violation of speedy trial at the trial level in this case. Section 18.1405 of the Colorado Revised Statutes is controlling. And one thing, I guess, as a threshold matter that I realized in my preparation for today's argument is with regard to subsections 4 and 5.1 and perhaps an overly liberal reading of section 5.1 that I did in the briefing in this case. If the court is to review subsection 4 of the Speedy Trial Statute, that subsection deals with a prosecution motion for a continuance. And I don't think there's any question from reviewing the record that this court is aware that the prosecution in this case at the trial level did seek a continuance based on their allegation of the unavailability of their officer. And so at that point, the court should have looked to subsection 4, and that requires that upon the prosecution's request, the defense, if the request is made in open court, expressly agree to the continuance in order to avoid a speedy trial analysis under subsection 6G, which is what the court proceeded to do. Obviously, at the trial level, no such express agreement was made by me or my client, so that necessitated a finding under 6G if the court was going to continue the trial beyond the then set speedy trial time limit. So with regard to whether or not an express objection must have been made to the proposed trial date under 5.1, I think if we read 5.1 to require that in the case of a continuance, then subsection 4 is obviated. So I think we need to be careful not to read 5.1 too broadly to essentially obviate the necessity of a defense consent to a prosecution continuance. And so that's kind of the way that the argument has been focused in the brief, and I think it's important that the court also consider subsection 4 in its analysis. With regard to the findings under subsection 6G, I think even the Attorney General in their answer brief has admitted that an appropriate finding with regard to the future availability of Bernhardt was not made by the trial court, and I guess is asking at this point that the Court of Appeals perhaps make that finding itself. However, the cases cited by the Attorney General make it clear that it is a burden of the prosecuting attorney and the trial court to make appropriate findings under 6G. And that's, I believe, the Roberts case stands for that position, that specifically the prosecution and the trial court have that obligation, the burden to satisfy subsection 6G. In this case. Further, I would argue that the record makes clear that the prosecution at the trial level had no idea. I believe that is the exact phrase that they used. So I think at this, and I'm quoting from Ms. Luton during the hearing that was had at the trial level, in the initial trial setting in this case, she said, "So I think at this point, because we have no idea whether or not Mr. Bernhardt's going to be able to get out of the hospital, let alone testify, we are going to ask formally for a continuance." So at that point, there was no evidence whatsoever, or even statement from the prosecuting attorney that the trial court could rely on with regard to the future availability of Mr. Bernhardt. And because the record is devoid of any such evidence or even reference from the prosecuting attorney, even if the court were inclined to attempt to make its own, findings
counsel, could the trial court rely on the statements of counsel as an officer of the court?
I think so, and I've reviewed the case law, and it appears clear to me that the trial court could rely on the representations that were being made by the prosecution, but no representation was made by the prosecution to the trial court regarding Mr. Bernhardt's future availability. And I think that's the issue that creates a problem for the prosecution and is the reason why the trial court was unable to make an appropriate finding under subsection 6G and why this court can't make such a finding now. So,
let me just clarify. So was Mr. Bernhardt later available?
He was later available. But the analysis, we can't use hindsight, as the court's aware, it's 2020. The fact that he was available was not known to the trial court. That's the point. At the time of the analysis that it was statutorily required to perform under 6G, at the initial trial date, there was no evidence whatsoever that was available to it indicating that Mr. Bernhardt would be later available. As I indicated, the prosecution made specific reference to the fact that they had no idea.
Couldn't the trial court rely on the colloquy of counsel that indicated that they thought he would be okay or by the date that they ultimately scheduled the trial for?
And I don't know that the colloquy that that Your Honor has described is made clear in the briefing.
It's not as clear as you would like to have it be, but couldn't the court rely on that as an indication that both counsel thought this man would be out of the hospital and probably ready to testify at that point?
I guess I don't think so. I think that court reviews the transcript of the proceeding that occurred that day, I think what the colloquy revealed was that there was reluctance to set at the initial setting that was agreed upon by both counsel that was within speedy trial because the prosecution had a concern that the deputy Bernhardt wouldn't be available at that setting. And so the fact that a later date was then ultimately adopted by the court, I don't think so. I don't think that concern was, I guess there's no evidence that it was alleviated. I think there was some caution with regard to setting very quickly based upon concerns that and the prosecution's representations to the court that they had no idea when Mr. Bernhardt would be available. But the fact that caution caused a later trial date setting, I don't think implies that later date was necessarily going to or was believed to necessarily come after Mr. Bernhardt's recovery. I guess maybe I'm not saying that as well.
Well, I understand, but the comment that was made by the assistant DA was that counsel for both parties were concerned that maybe Deputy Bernhardt won't be great by the time of the proposed date, and the implication is that at the later date that he would that was anticipated that he would be prepared. I mean, it's one of those things where there's nothing directly on the record, but isn't this an inference that the trial court was allowed to draw?
I don't think so. I think the inference that could be drawn is that there was caution, that there was pessimism with regard to Mr. Bernhardt's immediate recovery, and that.
Well, what kind of a showing would have to be made to satisfy your view?
I think what would make sense is if the court heard some evidence from a treating physician regarding a potential recovery timeline, or if at least the prosecuting attorney had requested some sort of information from the treating physician regarding a potential timeline of recovery and then tendered that to the court. I think at that point, the court would be armed with sufficient information to determine whether or not Mr. Bernhardt would be available at the next setting or when he might be available in the future. And no such inquiry was made by the prosecution, and no such offer of proof was tendered by it to the trial.
So, Mr. Crowther, given that Mr. Bernhardt was available for the trial, mm-hmm. what was the harm to your client? I mean, I could understand if, you know, eventually the Mr. Bernhardt was not available, we'd have a pretty serious problem here. But he was available, so how was your client unfairly prejudiced?
Well, he was unfairly prejudiced by the delay in his trial. He's statutorily entitled to a trial within 6 months, and he was denied that through no fault of his own. So his trial and his day in court was unnecessarily delayed through no fault of his own without appropriate findings.
Okay, thank you.
I see that I have about 5 minutes left. I'm going to touch on, I guess, the other issues that I've raised in the briefing lightly. I don't believe that we should get there based on the speedy trial issue that has been presented, but if we did, I do believe that there are legitimate issues with regard to the cross-examination of CL in this case, and the court's unnecessary and inappropriate limitation of my cross-examination regarding his forgery activity while he was a juvenile. And I believe the Attorney General has indicated in their answer brief again that the court did not utilize the appropriate analysis, and at that trial level agreed with the prosecution, who indicated that because it was a juvenile record, that it was completely out of bounds, and the acts even that underlies the adjudication were also out of bounds. The Attorney General has adopted a different position, obviously, than the trial level prosecution team did, and indicates that it was at least arguably permissible under 608B. The point of the matter is that the trial court didn't utilize the appropriate analysis at that time. It's something that should have gone to the jury, and the jury should have been able to assess it and apply the appropriate amount of weight to those acts.
Excuse me, counsel, pardon me for interrupting, but I'm confused, because as I understand what you said at the trial court, that you didn't want to ask about the adjudication itself.
Correct.
As I understand your opening brief, you are saying that the trial court should have allowed you to ask about the adjudication.
That's true.
Didn't you waive that by telling the trial court that you didn't want to ask about it in the trial court?
Well, I think the adjudication and the facts underlying the forgery adjudication are very closely linked. I didn't intend to get into the adjudication at that time, but the court limited my ability to cross-examine the witness based on the fact that it did result in adjudication. I think ultimately an inquiry with regard to the adjudication itself may have been appropriate at that time. But
you said you weren't going to do it, so why would it be error for the trial court to say, no, you can't ask about the adjudication?
Well, it prohibited me from asking about the underlying facts as well.
So I understand that, but your argument on appeal, as I understand it, is not that you weren't allowed to ask about the underlying facts, it's that you weren't allowed to ask about the adjudication. Am I missing something?
Well, I think what I'm arguing on appeal is and both. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is the acts and the, and ultimately, I guess, the fact that they amounted to forgery. And the fact that because this witness had committed an act of forgery, that is something that the jury should have been aware about. It has something to do with his credibility, and is something that should have been weighed by them instead of precluded by the trial court. So I think it was error for the trial court to preclude that. And I guess the point is that it didn't employ the correct analysis at that time and should have employed a 608B analysis. And because it didn't do that, it abused its discretion. I'd like to reserve
two minutes
if I may.
Counsel, I'll tell you what, we've used a lot of your time with questions, so I'll give you a bit of extra time if you need it.
Okay, I appreciate it.
You can reserve your time and any additional time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, John First for the people. Under the speedy trial statute, where trial date is offered and neither the defendant nor his attorney expressly objects to the date offered as being beyond speedy trial, and the period is extended, and essentially he's waived speedy for that period of time. And there was no express objection to the offered date as being beyond speedy trial. All we had was at the end of the hearing, when the court asked, is there anything else, counsel said, we just note their objection. Defense just notes their objection after the trial date was set and providing no reason. And I think that's important. I mean, we know that this hearing was about continuing the trial, but, early on in the proceeding, and this is all in my brief, defense counsel said, I don't know what kind of grounds I have to make. It said that we were ready to go to trial. That's why we came here. However, this kind of an exigent circumstance that I do believe was unforeseen by the prosecution. So I don't know what kind of grounds I have to make an objection. Certainly, other than that, I know that my client wants to proceed and we're ready to do so. That is the extent of any specific objection. There was no objection. In fact, counsel participated in setting the trial initially within Speedy, and then after they went off the record, came back, said, well, prosecutor said that both defense counsel and the prosecutor thought that we're a little hesitant to go 2 weeks out because deputy might not be ready to go yet. Then they set it outside of Speedy in August from, I think this was May to August. Again, no objection. There was participation in that setting. And so when they says at the end of that hearing, we just note their objection. I mean, it's clearly not expressed, and it could just as easily have been, and more likely in the context, have gone to their objection not to go to trial that day. And I think under the statute, that's just under section 5.1, it's just not enough. And with regard to 406 1G, of course it's the burden of the prosecution and the court to establish the three elements. Counsel argues here that it was a burden to make findings and cites Roberts for that proposition. Well, Roberts doesn't go quite that far when certain aspects of certain requirements were never questioned. And the court in Roberts explicitly said that, noted twice in the opinion that due diligence and future unavailability were never questioned. And that's the case here. There was nothing, there's actually nothing questioned. No element of the required showing unavailability, material evidence, due diligence, and future unavailability. None of that was questioned at the time. And at the beginning of the new trial date, the only grounds for objection at that point was there wasn't actual evidence of the reasons for the unavailability. But of course, the courts rely, and cases are pretty uniform. Roberts is one that comes to mind first that can rely on proffers by the prosecution, statements by the prosecutor as an officer of the court. You know, counsel says, well, what kind of evidence would have sufficed? Maybe a physician statement. Well, maybe if it had been questioned. I mean, and that's exactly what happened in Roberts. The court said, you know, it had to do having to do with inconsistent statements, but that aspect of the, you know, counsel never questioned whether or not going to the materiality, whether the statements were truly inconsistent and therefore material. So, you know, maybe more would have been needed, but there was enough information on the record to satisfy that, and because it wasn't questioned, no more was necessary. That's the same thing here. Physician statement, maybe, but it was never questioned.
Whose burden is it? Is the burden on the prosecution to show that the witness will be available in the future, even if it isn't questioned?
Well, ultimately, it is the prosecution and the court's burden to establish that. But then, as you asked earlier, I mean, what constitutes that sufficient showing? And I think you're right that, you know, we can, they can infer from the way it was handled that he would be available at a later date, and there's nothing in the record to suggest otherwise. We knew the information we had. It was actually come, it truly was second, it was secondhand, but the sheriff had actually gone, the sheriff himself had gone to the hospital to check on the deputy and phoned it in to the prosecutor. I'm not sure when, during the recess at least, but that he was unavailable then. But I mean, there was nothing that it would be an extended hospital stay. There was nothing like that. Certainly there was nothing in the record to establish that it was terminal. At that point, you know, without questioning, again, it's our position that has to be a sufficient record in the absence of any dispute as to the future unavailability.
So do I understand correctly that notwithstanding the statute, if no one raises it, then the prosecutor need not make an offering, and the court need not make a finding?
That's essentially our position. I mean, it has to be.
So essentially, it's not preserved then. If there's not an objection to that issue, then the issue is not preserved.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's important because you've deprived, I mean, I understand that it's not the defendant's burden, but by coming in on appeal and raising a brand new claim, these are new arguments, they've deprived the parties of meeting their burden. At least prevented. And unless the court has other questions about the speedy trial, I'll. And unless the court has questions on the second issue, the cross examination. I mean, we conceded it was probably error for the court not to allow examination, cross examination of the facts, not the adjudication, but the facts of the that underlay the. Prior juvenile adjudication, but I set forth several reasons why it's not reversible. And as a federal constitution matter, I will say that it's certainly it's plain error as to any Sixth Amendment claim. Otherwise, it's just non-constitutional, harmless, and there's. I think I listed at least five reasons.
You're saying the standard of review is plain error. You're not conceding that what the trial court did was a plain error? I'm just making sure I understand.
The standard review with regard to the constitutional claim is under the plain error standard.
Okay.
We're conceding that the court should have allowed some limited inquiry into it, but that error doesn't rise to the level of plain error with regard to any Sixth Amendment claim, and it's certainly harmless with regard to 608B. And unless the court has any questions on anything else, I just ask that you affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. First. Oh, did you have more?
No, I thought you were asking me a question.
No, I'm sorry. No, thank you. Bailiff, if you would give Mr. Crowther an extra 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I guess I'd like to start by replying to some of the argument that was made by the prosecution with regard to the speedy trial issue and whether or not there was an express objection at the time of this hearing at the initial trial setting. I think certainly there was. If the court reviews the record with regard to the colloquy between myself and the trial court judge, it's clear that at that point I wasn't sure what my grounds for objection would be with regard to the setting outside of speedy trial and the prosecution's motion for continuance, but there is no requirement in the speedy trial statute that I be specific. It has
express language within that statute that simply says, in the case of a motion for continuance, that I must agree. I certainly didn't do that. It says with regard to proposed trial dates in 5.1, which I read to mean initial proposed trial dates, because if, as I indicated in my initial argument, if we read that 5.1 to apply to trial dates associated with the prosecution motion to continuance, our motion for continuance, then subsection 4 is just obviated. And we need to read that statute so that those subsections are harmonious with each other and attempt not to obviate subsections of the law that are still in existence. So if we read 5.1 as broadly as is requested by the prosecution now, we are not harmonizing subsections 4 and subsections 5.1, and we need to do that. So with regard to that, I think no need for an express objection is required at that time with regard to a continuance and subsequent setting. But if there is a requirement that an express objection be made, I don't think there's any question that the trial court, the prosecution, everyone that was in that courtroom understood the defense to be objecting. The basis for objection, as I've indicated, isn't as clear or at that time, before this court even made the 6G analysis, I've clearly indicated we're ready to proceed to trial. We want to proceed to trial. So that was the reason for the objection. And I think that's clear. To read it some other way and to read that as not being an objection, I think is error to read the record that way, as the defense not objecting to the continuance. And whether or not the defense should then be forced to object again and again as each trial date is offered, I think is a little bit ridiculous to say that there is some obligation that the defendant must say, April 1st, objection, but that works on my calendar. You know, June 6th, objection, but that works on my calendar. I think at some point it becomes ridiculous that there would be some kind of a requirement placed on the defendant to verbalize the objection that everyone understands and continue to reiterate that objection when everyone understands that the objection has been made and that findings under 6G are necessary in order to set the trial date out. The court at that point, when we were wrangling over trial dates, had already made its indication that it's made findings that a continuance under 6G was appropriate. As the prosecution admits now, that finding was an error. Essentially, there was no evidence indicating the future availability of Mr. Bernhardt, and the record makes that perfectly clear. You know, and to read in, it really strains the record, I think, beyond the point where it would be appropriate to do so, to insert some sort of assumption that based on the fact that some future trial date is eventually agreed upon means that both parties agree that that witness that the prosecution at that time had indicated was material was then going to be available. I think that is too much to insert into the record based on the fact that a trial date is ultimately set, because at that hearing, a trial date was going to be set. That doesn't mean that the defense is necessarily stipulating that Mr. Bernhardt is going to be available at that future date.
Thank you, Mr. Crowther. Having received the briefs and heard oral argument, the case now stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. This